Next up, where can you buy the cheapest cheeseburger in the U.S.? Turns out that that cholesterol paradise is just up the road from Nashville, a piece in Clarksville, Tennessee, where the average price is just $3.50. To satisfy you vegan listeners, if it's greens you're after, why not head for the kale capital of the U.S.? That would be in Cambridge, Massachusetts, of course. Wondering how we discovered these goodies? It was data, sweet data. My next guest has been crunching the food numbers for us to answer questions that might be impossible to answer any other way. Hillary Mason is the data scientist in residence at Accel Partners and scientist emeritus at Bitly. She's no stranger to using big data to find a good meal. She joins me in New York to help us walk us through how you get from data point A to point B, as in burger. Welcome to the program. Welcome
back.
Thank
you.
Let's talk about this. How did you find all that stuff? Let's talk about that burger. How do you find the best burger?
So I've been mildly obsessed with data about cheeseburgers for a little while. It's my favorite meal, always has been, and I've written algorithms to try to find the best burger in New York. And so this was actually a little project where I used an API called Loku. It's out there in public. It's a company I have no relationship with. I signed up and in about 20 lines of code had written a little program that pulled burger menu items from the top 100 metro areas in the United States by zip code. And that code's actually up on my website and GitHub, github.com/hmason, if anyone wants to improve it or take a look. And so from that, it's easy to say, okay, you know, what is the zip code with the highest average price for a cheeseburger, which happens to be Santa Clara, California, at least
no
right
kidding.
Now.
Yeah. And what's the price there?
It was $18.50.
$18.50 for a cheeseburger?
And the great irony of this is that the Strata Data Science Conference is happening right now in Santa Clara. So I feel for all of my friends and colleagues who are out there stuck
with
$18 burgers.
So
yes, conference land.
That's right. And so you can find that by just searching what is out there.
Yeah, just putting in a query like cheeseburger, a zip code that you're interested in, taking the data that comes back and parsing it in a few different ways. Another one I looked at is pizza, because everyone in the world loves pizza.
Number one food.
It absolutely is. You can see pepperoni is the most popular topping, anchovies among the least popular. It's not a surprise, but it's nice to see what we know reflected back to us in that data set.
Mm-hmm. And also pad thai. Did you look at pad thai for us?
I did. And yeah, it's another one that's popular around the U.S., more so on the coasts.
Right. Okay. We're going to come back and talk lots more about this. Our number 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to talk about big data with Hillary Mason, we're going to bring on Max Schroen and Alex Andy Pendland coming up after the break. Stay with us. You can also tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI and join a discussion on our website at sciencefriday.com. More big data after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Before the break, data scientist Hillary Mason clued us in on how to find cheap eats, crunch some data. What else can data do? Joining the conversation now are two other data geeks, and I say that with great enthusiasm and admiration. Max Schroen is author of the new book Thinking with Data and co-founder of the Schroen and Company, a data science consultancy. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday, Max.
Hi, Eric. Great to be here.
Speaking of geeks out there, and San Francisco is certainly a hub.
Yeah, I'm actually based in New York. I was actually out here for Strata.
Well, there you go. Well, you know where the
expensive
burger? And the
cheeseburgers were very expensive. I had one, and it was about $20.
No kidding. Prices going up as we speak. Wait, yeah. Include tax. Alex Sandy Pentland is a professor at MIT and author of Social Physics. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Pentland.
Thank you. Just call me Sandy, please.
Okay, Sandy. Hillary, let's follow up first on this big data. You've been crunching this big data all the time for quite a bit. What is the general purpose of it? What can we get out of all this big data?
Turning the lights on. Data gives us insight into things happening in the world that we otherwise have no way to perceive. And that's why I'm generally pretty excited to learn new things with different data sets.
Yeah. Max, in your book, Thinking with Data, you talk about how it's important to ask good questions in data science. Mm-hmm. How do you ask the data the right question?
So I think it's important to think about big data. Maybe is not quite the right term here, we've got data that's really fine-grained. We've got all these sensors everywhere now that really measure things in ways that couldn't be measured before. And the tools have gotten so mature that it doesn't really make sense to spend all our time talking about the tools. So I think that asking good questions ends up being looking a lot like a design process, a lot like talking to the right people and making the right kinds of mock-ups and the right kind of interviews, the same way that you might want to design a chair or design a house. Now we're at the point where we can focus on that rather than focusing on all the math.
Now, it's sort of a throwback to the old GIGO question or idea in computer, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't ask the right question, right, you're not going to get what you're looking for.
Now, I think it's really easy to take a data set now if you have the skill with the computer, the skill with statistics, and just try everything possible with it. And sometimes you find something good, but I think having a really thoughtful approach, I mean, in Hillary's case, it wasn't just that she saw an API and said, I'm going to query for every restaurant menu item in the country and then figure out which place has got the most expensive item. She came in knowing that she cared about cheeseburgers and she had interesting questions about pad thai and about pizza. And it's sort of a fun example, but it goes to show that, it was the question that made the work interesting and not the data itself.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, you're using data to redesign bus routes in places like the Ivory Coast. Tell us about that.
Well, what I'm doing is I'm taking big data and revisiting all the questions of social science, how societies become creative, how disease propagates, and how transportation works. And an example of this is I helped talk the carrier Orange into releasing all of their data in an aggregate form for the country, the Ivory Coast. And then we invited universities from all around the world to work with this data to do good for the country, because the country is not only poor, but it's had a civil war. And the things we found that we could do is we could improve transportation by about 10% for almost no money, because now we knew where people began and where they ended up. We could do the same for infectious disease because we knew how the disease could propagate, because it propagates by people mixing. And most interesting, perhaps, is we were able to actually map out poverty and suffering in different parts of the country, even in parts of the country that the government officials can't go to because of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. 1-844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. 8255, if you'd like to call and join a conversation. Hillary, it's Valentine's Day, and you helped us find the cheapest place to take a date on a budget for a burger. but if you still need a date, here's where Max comes in. Max, tell us about your days at the dating website OkCupid. What does OkCupid look for? What sort of things do you see in the data there?
So, I came into OkCupid a couple years back. I was there for a few years, and site's fantastic. It's essentially you answer a lot of questions about yourself and what you're looking for in somebody and how important it is to you, and then the folks who developed the algorithms behind OkCupid wrote the systems that take all that data and crunch it together and spit out essentially a list of people for you to go interact with. And they know that you're never going to find exactly truly the right one just with the data, but the point is to surface the right people to go meet. It's like being in a bar, and instead of seeing 100 people, you only see the 5 that you might actually get along with.
Mm-hmm. And did going through that data tell you something about the people who visit the site? Is that part of what you're looking for?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So I worked on some of the data work with Christian Rutter, who is the founder of the blog and one of the founders of OkCupid. And we found all kinds of really amazing correlations out there. I think my favorite one is looking at the questions that are people don't mind answering. Right. And seeing how well they predict questions that they kind of want to keep hidden. Because one of the things you can do on OkCupid is you can choose to answer a question publicly or privately. And so we looked at the data and said, what are the public questions that correlate with the private ones? And my favorite is that people who are open to, people who like the taste of beer are twice as likely to being open to having sex on a first date. That's my absolute favorite one. And again, it's not saying that there's a necessarily a causal relationship here, but it's saying that there's something different about the kinds of people who like beer and the kinds of people who, might want a little something the first time you take them out to dinner.
Mm-hmm. You also found three key questions that seem to be a key to a match made in heaven. Can you go over those?
That's right. That's right. That's another one of my favorite results on there.
Yeah. What are those?
So you'd think that the questions that would be most predictive of success are things like, do you believe in God? Are you, how do you feel about money? And What we found working with this data was that actually it was the three questions that were the best predictive of the people who quit successfully were, would you ever chuck it all and go live in a sailboat? Do you like horror movies? And have you ever traveled alone abroad? And people who answered all three of those the same way actually were eight times as likely to successfully quit together than people who had randomly met each other on the site.
Eight times as likely to leave OkCupid because they've gotten their work done there and they found somebody?
That's right. That's right.
Wow.
I know.
Just those three questions.
For...
Would you chuck it all and go live on a sailboat? Have you traveled alone ever? And do you like scary movies?
That's right.
Great.
So I haven't been there for a few years, but they keep doing a lot of fantastic work. And I know that that Christian, who's the one who originally started the blog, actually I think has got a book himself coming out by the end of the year about some of the same kind of stuff. So I'm looking forward to reading that when it gets out there.
Mm-hmm. Hillary, you're very optimistic about the ability of data to make our lives better. But, you know, in light of something like the data gathering by the NSA, people are afraid. How do you weigh the good and the bad of all this data in privacy issues? Are you saying that we shouldn't be so worried, or what are your feelings about that?
So I'm naturally an optimist, and I do really believe that data gives us superpowers, and I do actually mean that, and that it gives us the ability to perceive things we could not otherwise perceive. But when you make a statement like that, it becomes clear that sometimes having those things perceived is a wonderful thing, and sometimes it can be used in a fairly awful way. And so I do think we need to have a much more robust public conversation about privacy, not just with respect to the NSA and our government's use of data, but with respect to corporate use of data, in that right now as a consumer, you not only don't have the right to know what data is being collected about you, what data is being inferred about you from the data that's been collected, you don't even get to know when they sell that data to someone else and who else might have access to that. And I don't think that's an ideal environment for us to live in as citizens and consumers.
Should you have a right to limit what they can take from you when you're surfing or online or something?
Well, I'm certainly not going to propose policy, but I do believe in transparency, and I do believe that companies and organizations should make it clear to people what data they are collecting and what they will do with it.
So do you think that people should be as concerned as they are about the NSA, but be as concerned about what corporations are learning about them?
Yes, and people should be aware that their behavior is being recorded and may be used to infer other things about them. And so one of the challenges is that perhaps a data point by itself doesn't tell much. Like, maybe I went to the doctor today. That could be a routine physical, or it could be something else. But if you know I went to the doctor today, I went to the pharmacy today, and I stayed in and ordered soup for dinner, then you know I'm probably ill. So you're able to conclude something from independent data points where alone they don't tell you very much, but combined they might actually violate my privacy.
If your insurance company is tracking you, it knows that you're doing these things.
Yes, if anyone is.
If anyone is. Sandy, how do you think about that?
Well, for the last 5 years, I've run a conversation in Davos between some of the senior regulators and advocacy groups and the corporations. And the issue is not just privacy, but we also need to have this data flowing in order to do things like better transportation, better healthcare, more creative societies. So there's a tension there. And the conclusion that you see now coming into regulation is that individuals should be able to control data about them, and that they should be able to audit what happens to that data. And the idea is that, first of all, that protects the individual, puts the choice where it should be with the individual. But by having that auditing function and putting the individual in control, it makes sharing of information safer, and people will do it more, which means that we can get better government, better systems, and so on and so forth. So that's the way things are going, which I think is pretty good. There's a lot of battles between here and there. And as Hillary was saying, one of the big battles is the sort of corporations, a lot of them web companies, that have grown up in the sort of data wild, wild west and have no rules about this.
Mm-hmm. Max, you give a talk called How to Kill Your Grandmother with Statistics about how data can be manipulated. Can you tell us about that? A little thumbnail
absolutely.
Of that.
Sure. I think statistics, you know, is a very powerful discipline. But it's easy to be misled if somebody waves some statistics at you and think that that's the end of the conversation, that, you know, full stop, we discovered in the data, we're done. And the point of that talk is basically that if you make your number crunching a black box where data comes in and answers come out and we don't really critically examine this, you're going to wind up being easily manipulated. And the example in the talk is talking about a drug that had been in the market for a couple of years, that it turned out there had been strong evidence of additional heart attacks in the patients who were taking it. And, you know, there ended up being a number of lawsuits when it came out that the folks who were running these studies had essentially been compromised and were, you know, cherry-picking a couple people because they knew that if they just kicked out one or two people here or there, it would drop below a certain p-value and then they could, you know, cut off the conversation.
Is that the Vioxx study?
That is the Vioxx study. That's right.
Vioxx study. So how do we protect ourselves? Mm-hmm. Or how do we ensure that the data is good stuff?
So I think it's as much about the data as it is about the conversation that has to happen around how we make decisions with data. I think we have to recognize that data is just a small piece of a much bigger argument you have to make whenever you want to make a policy claim or you want to say that we should do anything differently. Mm-hmm. And you know, the data's got to be there, but it's got to be taken in the right context as being, you know, relying on a lot of other intuition, a lot of prior science, a lot of existing ideas that are out there in the policy world. And we can't just say, well, the data says this, therefore we're going to change it all to accommodate that.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about the use of big data with Hillary Mason, Max Schroen, and Sandy Pendlin. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, if you'd like to give us a call. Let's go to the phone. So, yeah, let's go. There's some interesting calls are coming in. Let's go to Adam. Hi, welcome to Science Friday, Adam. Adam, are you there? Oh, guess we lost Adam. He was the first of his kind. I'm sorry. 844-724-8255. First caller on the phones today. Let's go to John. Let's see if John is there. Hi, John in Falls Church. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi there.
I was told I was fifth, and suddenly I'm first. Thank you. I wanted to ask about their use of crowdsourcing to find the right questions to ask. There is the intelligence of crowds that says that might be a useful source for better questions, because that seems to be a major issue of how to use the big data. And how do we categorize the sources for big data, for big food, big healthcare, big education, big housing? There's huge amounts of information that can tell us a lot about how we could use our democratic processes a lot more effectively.
Hillary, you want to take a shot at that? Thank you.
So thinking about the first part of your question, you know, can we crowdsource good questions? Absolutely. I think the best questions don't come from data scientists. The best questions come from people who are concerned about the world they live in. And there's currently several efforts underway to sort of democratize data science, to build tools that are so simple that anyone can do a fairly rigorous analysis and come to understand something from data, but we're definitely not there yet. So yes, I think there's a big opportunity to draw questions from people who have the domain knowledge and are concerned about a topic.
Is there any way for an average person who wants to use crowdsourcing or data collection to do it, you know, without having to be an expert?
So there is a ton of brilliant data science work that is done in Microsoft Excel. And, you know, we live in a world where all business professionals are expected to be fluent with Microsoft Excel. And so, I think it's quite possible for an average person to do great work. But it's not as easy as it should be yet.
Somebody else was jumping in there?
Yeah, Sandy, I'm a little suspicious of just doing analysis and crowdsourcing things because this is really sort of a new set of questions, a new set of experiences. And what I've been trying to do, and I see other people also setting up what are called living labs, which is when people come up with suggestions and the data seems to support it, rather than making a new law or saying everybody should do this, try it on a small scale first. And so we've set up like MIT, the university, different towns in Europe and other places where the rules are a little different. And some of the rules are things that are suggested by big data. And also some of the rules are things where people are able to contribute their ideas to sort of not quite crowdsourcing, but a much more open forum than other places. Some of these labs won't work, but some of them are going to come up with really interesting new ways to live that other people can then copy.
Hmm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our conversation with Max Schroen, Hillary Mason, and Sandy Pentland. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Go to our website where we're talking about this at sciencefriday.com. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about a productive use of the wealth of information you leave behind as you surf the web, you talk on the phone, you take pictures. Can we use all this stuff to improve our everyday lives? How do you use it? My guests are Hillary Mason, data scientist in residence at Accel Partners, Max Schroen, author of Thinking with Data and founder of Schroen and Company, Sandy Pentland, a professor of MIT and author of Social Physics. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's go back to talking about these little labs that you're setting up, Sandy, the living laboratory. Tell us exactly what you do with this. Is it a test bed to try out data gathering there and see if it actually would work in real time?
Yeah. So, for instance, at MIT here, what we're doing is reorganizing things so that the students, the faculty, and the people who work here are in control of things like data about where they come and go, data about their health interactions with the local sort of health clinic here. The students will have access to all the records about them. And the idea is to give people a lot more transparency into what's being recorded about them, and also for them to understand what they should share in order to get the systems to work better.
You know, the Internet of Things is the hot new phrase these days, meaning that just about everything is going to be connected to the Internet, from your refrigerator, which I now understand can send out spam to people.
Yep.
Could be hijacked, right?
You bet, yeah.
To your vacuum cleaner, to what the latest hot item is, your car. Your car is just another data center of all sorts.
Yep.
So are we going to see an explosion in all this data?
Well, it's really worrisome, too, right? Because this is going to corporates that, you know, have no particular relationship with you. I mean, when your refrigerator is telling somebody in another country about your eating habits, that's a pretty scary thing. So you really have to get this under control by giving people the control of data that all of your bits and pieces, your refrigerators and cars and so forth, are putting out. Otherwise, we're going to live in a world full of people spying on you.
But Sandy, it's also, I mean, I agree, but it's also really helpful. Like, I'm wearing an accelerometer on my wrist that's counting the number of steps I take and monitors how well I'm sleeping. And just from looking at the little app that comes with that, I've been able to see that when I travel on business, I sleep an hour and a half less per night and I walk 1,000 steps fewer per day. And so that's made me much more aware of my health when I travel. And that's just a fairly obvious sort of level zero use of this technology. I think it actually has the potential to help us make much better health decisions.
It has huge potential. But the point is that data went to you first, and then you could decide to share it. Things like, for instance, the Nest thermometer goes to Google first, and only then do you get to see the data. I think that's the thing that's backward. Data is actually really interesting for improving our lives, but we should be in charge of it.
Mm. And now we're going to have wearable data. More, you talked about your little wristband there, but you know there are stories about companies buying up the designers of fashion wear. You know, and more wristbands coming out. Every perceivable thing, your shoes, whatever you have, will be sending data out.
And that's right.
You know, and even even medical stuff about you. Which might be on the positive side.
Yeah, and there's great good. Like, for instance, we have a collaboration with Mass General. We're to look at all of that sort of data for certain class of employees that they have in order to be able to really understand diseases like diabetes better or depression better. But it makes George Orwell look like somebody who was very not imaginative when you imagine all that data going to corporates, God knows where, and perhaps reselling it to your insurance company or others.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to George in Huntington, New York. Hi, George. George, are you there? Hey, George. George? Oh. Having trouble with phones today. Well, it's data again.
Old technology.
These are IP phones.
New technology.
So
are we on a collision course? Or I mean, because of people who are worried about the big data, all the data from all this new stuff, and people who want, hey, you know, I don't mind if you know that I'm taking a hike because I need some new shoes. Maybe you'll send me an ad for the kinds of shoes I want or something like that. Is there a collision course? Is there some place in between?
The point is you ought to be able to say, oh, I'm open to these sorts of things and I'm not open to those sorts of things. Another thing to remember is this is not just the United States. This is in places like Germany and Brazil and other places that are happening. And many of those places don't have quite the happy governments, the history of happy government that we have. And they're aware that, you know, should the government go in the wrong direction or should other sorts of political things happen, this data can be used to really devastating effect.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And the same data that can have a negative effect and that they might be tracking me as I walk down the street in Manhattan and know that I did not go into a certain store and I went into another store and they can send ads to me based on that. And that's actually happening is the same data that lets the city understand pedestrian traffic flow so they can better route ambulances.
Mm-hmm.
So it's opening up a lot of possibility, some of which is brilliant and some of which is not.
Mm-hmm. Is there a chance that we're not collecting good data, though? Are there pieces who are not part, don't like to be part of this big data collection, who are off the web? They're, you know, since they're not included, we're not getting a true picture.
Yeah, I would say that that's absolutely true, but I think that's fine. I think the idea that we're going to have a God's eye view of the world with just enough data doesn't hold up. And this has been a dream. It's been a dream of social scientists now going back a very long way. You look back in the 50s at the cybernetics movement, and there was this idea that we were on the verge of understanding the systems that made the world tick. And that perspective that said we knew everything and we could predict on the ground is part of why we ended up with how things went in Vietnam. I mean, you ask Robert McNamara what he thought about data back in the early 60s, and they really thought that data was the key to understanding everything. So I'm actually okay with having a dash of humility in here and knowing that there are always, you know, wild cards that aren't there that are going to throw a bit of a wrench in there, and that's fine. I think we are on a course to use this data very productively. There's a project in based out of New York and a couple places now called DataKind that uses gets volunteers to work with nonprofits to look at their data to do really fantastic things in cities. Sometimes there was one project that they did looking at downed trees all over New York and trying to help the Parks Department figure out where to prune. And this is, you know, these are examples of really productive, you know, very helpful things to do with data. And I think as long as we keep in mind that these things are always not going to be exactly right, they're going to give us a lot of good benefit.
Mm-hmm. And today, as I wrap up, if you'd like to find where that cheapest cheeseburger is, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got the listing for the whole country just about. Hillary put a nice graph for us together. Thank you, Hillary. Thank you all.
My pleasure.
Hillary Mason.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hillary Mason, data scientist in residence at Accel Partners. Max Schroen, author of Thinking with Data and founder of Schroen and Company. Sandy Pentland, a professor at MIT, author of Social Physics. Happy Valentine's Day to all of you.